Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for standing by. Welcome to Value Partner Group 2018 interim result conference call. The call will begin with a presentation by management, followed by a Q&A session. I would now like to hand over the call to Isabella Zhong from Value Partner's investor relations team.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to Value Partner Group's 2018 interim results conference call. Please allow me to introduce the management team on the call this evening. We have our Chief Executive Officer, Dr. Oh Keng Lim, and Chief Financial Officer, I.C. Wang. Before we proceed, a quick reminder that this presentation contains statements that reflect the company's current beliefs and expectations about the future as of the respective dates indicated. These forward-looking statements are based on a number of assumptions about the company's operations and factors beyond the company's control, are subject to significant risks and uncertainties, and accordingly, actual circumstances may differ materially from these forward-looking statements. We have posted a set of slides to accompany this presentation on our corporate website. Please kindly reference the slides as this presentation proceeds. A replay of this call will also be available on our corporate website later on. I would now like to pass the call to I.C., who will discuss the group's financial highlights.
Thank you, Isabella. Good evening, everyone. Thank you for joining us. I would like to begin with an overview of our financial highlights, which is presented on slide four of our interim results presentation. For the first half of 2018, Value Partners record total revenue of 958 million Hong Kong dollars, which is up 27% compared to a year ago. The increase was mainly driven by a 30% increase in our gross management fees on the back of higher assets under management and a widening of our gross management fee margin. Average AUM for the first half of 2018 increased 22% compared to the first half of 2017, while our annualized gross management fee margin expanded to 104 basis points from 98 basis points a year ago, as our Greater China High Yield Income Fund continued to attract strong inflows. Our annualized net management fee margin widened to 60 basis points from 57 basis points a year ago. Despite the turn in market conditions this year, the success of our funds that record performance fee at mid-year were able to deliver a strong performance in the first half of 2018. As a result, our performance fees increased 127% compared to the first half of 2017 to 50 million Hong Kong dollars. On the back of our higher total revenue and continuously disciplined cost controls, our operating profit jumped 75% compared to a year ago to 246 million Hong Kong dollars. However, our net profit of 194 million Hong Kong dollars was 12% lower than what it was a year ago due to mark-to-market losses on seed capital investments against the weak market backdrop. Looking at slide five, the group finished the first half of 2018 with assets under management of 17.2 billion US dollars, which is an increase on the 15.5 billion we had a year ago and the 16.6 billion at the end of 2017. While the weak market conditions have weighed on our AUM, leading to a performance-driven decline of 677 million US dollars during the first half of 2018, we saw an important reversal in fund flows. We record a net subscription of 1.6 billion US dollars during the period, which compares to net redemption of 278 million US dollars that we saw in full year 2017. The inflow was mainly driven by continuous strong demand for our Greater China High Yield Income Fund and the growth of our business on the mainland of China. Please turn to slide six for a breakdown of our AUM. The split of AUM between our own brand funds and white label products remained at 73% and 27% as of the end of June, while our own brand funds attract solid inflows. As our product suite expands, our white label AUM also grew as we won new mandates and also from the strong inflows into our existing mandates on the mainland of China. By strategy, Long buys absolute return equity funds continue to be our largest asset class, accounting for 63% of total AUM. However, its shares dipped slightly as our fixed income AUM continued to grow on the back of strong inflows into our Greater China High Yield Income Fund. Fixed income now account for 35% of our total AUM. Hong Kong continues to be our largest geographical segment, accounting for 79% of total AUM. Although its shares has dipped slightly since the end of 2017, as our AUM from China saw marked growth. Our AUM from China accounts for 6% of total AUM and amounted to slightly over $1 billion at the end of June, which is up around 30% compared to the end of 2017. Looking at our cost structure on slide 7, our total expense in the first half of 2018 increased 18% compared to a year ago to 267 million Hong Kong dollars. The increase was mainly underpinned by higher remuneration expense. While our fixed expense rose 13% compared to a year ago, it grew at a slower pace compared to net management fees, which increased 28%. As such, our fixed cost coverage ratio, which is defined as net management fees divided by fixed expense, increased to 2.6 times in the first half of 2018, compared to 2.3 times a year ago. The group aims to maintain a fixed cost coverage ratio of more than 2 times for any given year to ensure fixed costs are adequately covered by net management fees, which are a relatively stable source of income. In light of the potential top-line pressure that could arise given the volatility in Asian stock markets this year, we are adopting a cautious approach to costs, cutting non-essential spending and seeking lower cost but potentially high-impact alternatives. While we are preparing to open new offices in U.S. and Malaysia later this year, the move is not expected to have a significant impact on costs, as we will be adopting the same lean structure and gradual warm-up approach for these offices as we did for our London office. Please turn to slide 8 for an overview of our financial position. As of the end of June, the group had 1.7 billion Hong Kong dollars of cash and equivalents on the balance sheet, compared to 2.2 billion Hong Kong dollars at the end of 2017. We also continued to maintain a position of zero debt. The lower cash position was mainly due to an increase in net investments, which rose from 1.8 billion Hong Kong dollars at the end of 2017 to 2.6 billion Hong Kong dollars at the end of June. To enhance the yield on our cash, we invested in around 600 million Hong Kong dollars of short-term debt securities in the first half of 2018. The securities have remaining tenors of less than a year. I would now like to hand the call over to Kang, who will present a review of the group business.
Thank you, Kaisi. Good evening, everyone. I'm pleased to share that despite the turn in market condition this year, we have made significant inroads with our business on the mainland of China and notable progress in broadening our product suite. We have also put in place a number of new initiatives that will strengthen our distribution capabilities and engagement with existing and potential clients. First, I would like to share an update on our business in China, which is highlighted on slide 10. As I see this, AUM from China saw significant growth in the first half of 2018 and was a key driver behind the strong net inflow that we enjoyed during that period. Although it is only early days in the growth of our China business, our AUM from China marked a humble but meaningful milestone this year by surpassing the $1 billion US dollar mark for the first time. It's also finished the first half of 2018 around 30% higher than what it was at the end of 2017, and almost double that at the end of 2016. The growth in our AUM from China during the period was mainly underwritten by the winning of new mandates and strong inflows into existing accounts, as well as the launch of our first own-branded private investment securities fund in January. Prior to obtaining the private fund management license last November, we were confident that our ample operating experience and strong network of business partners on the mainland of China would allow us to quickly establish a foothold in China's private funds market once we received approval. And that indeed has been the case. Besides taking only 2 months to roll out our first PFM fund, most of the fund's 100 million renminbi initial AUM came from external client inflows rather than internal seed capital. As of the end of June, the AUM of our first PFM fund stood at around 150 million renminbi, and we continue to see solid investor appetite for the product. In light of this momentum, we launched our second PFM fund in July and plan to launch another fund later this year, subject to regulatory approval. Another milestone that we locked in the first half of 2018 is the formation of our first private equity fund on the mainland of China. In June, our Shenzhen subsidiary, which holds the qualified foreign limited partnership license, signed a framework agreement with China Education Group to establish the China Education Fund. The fund will be among the first to enable both Chinese and global investors to invest directly in China's rapidly growing private education sector. It is scheduled to launch in early 2019, subject to regulatory approval, and has a target AUM of 5 billion RMB with a 5-year term that's extendable for 2 additional 1-year periods. Finally, we expect to receive approval for our flagship classic fund to join the mutual recognition of funds program in the near future, assuming there isn't a significant shift in government policy towards cross-border capital flows. Earlier this year, we also applied for our $3.1 billion US high dividend stocks fund to join the MRF program. I will now proceed to slide 11 to discuss our product suite expansion. We first began to broaden and diversify our product suite beyond equities in 2012 when we launched our flagship fixed income fund, namely the Greater China High Yield Income Fund. The fund has since grown into one of the largest funds of its type with an AUM of $5.5 billion. We have since added 5 more funds to our fixed income product suite, which now covers most of the risk spectrum. The latest addition was an Asian Total Return Bond Fund in April. With most of the groundwork for the growth of our fixed income offerings now complete, alternatives have become the next focus area in our product suite expansion. We anticipate strong demand for alternative investment funds in Asia as investors increasingly look to diversify across multi-asset classes. At the same time, the ripening ecosystem for alternative investment in China presents an exciting investment opportunity set that is attractive to fund investors globally. The low correlation in performance and flows between alternatives and traditional asset classes also make the asset class an appropriate addition to our AUM mix. In the coming year, we look to add a sizable private debt fund to complement the strong performing fixed income hedge fund that we launched late last year. We are also preparing to launch another real estate private equity fund with the same investment strategy as our first fund. Our first real estate fund, which launched in June 2017, continues to make exciting progress. It has now deployed 75% of its capital and will acquire 2 more assets in the second half of the year. Another new growth segment is our quantitative investment solutions business, which is making promising progress in developing new business initiatives and products to monetize its capabilities. We see opportunities to offer Southeast Asia-focused quant and ETF offerings. We also see opportunities to provide platform services as we look forward to the expected launch of ETF Connect in the near future. Please turn to slide 12. I'm pleased to share that we are on track to open an office in the U.S. later this year. The office will serve as a distribution hub that will allow us to better access and engage with institutional investors in North America as appetite for China and Asia investments among this segment builds. In addition to a U.S. office, we also plan to open a Malaysia office this year. Our Malaysia office and our existing Singapore office will complement each other in our coverage of Southeast Asia, East Asia, both product-wise and distribution-wise. Additionally, Malaysia will house our Southeast Asia-focused QIS initiatives and potential new business areas, such as Sharia-compliant funds. On the distribution front, a Malaysia office also makes for natural expansion to the strong distribution network and brand that we already have in the country. As IC highlighted earlier, the opening of these two new offices isn't expected to significantly impact our costs, given they will launch with a lean structure and have a gradual ramp up. Meanwhile, in Europe, our UK subsidiary, which launched in December 2016, received approval from the Financial Conduct Authority in March to provide regulated products and services in the UK. Additionally, we are looking to add an additional core China equity fund to the six funds that we are already distributing in Europe. We are also seeing promising prospects beyond our more established markets, including strong investor interest in our products in the Middle East, Africa, and North Asia. In Taiwan, we have recorded inflows into our equity funds from major institutional clients and are planning a number of distribution partnerships. While in South Korea, we are also working on a strategic distribution partnership with major investment houses and security firms. Our key business partner in Japan has also contributed to inflows. Finally, please turn to slide 13. Alongside expansion of our product suite and geographical presence, we have also been strengthening our distribution capabilities and engagement with existing and potential clients. In line with our push into the alternative arena, we have been making efforts to boost recognition of the Value Partners brand among global institutional investors. On the back of the appointment of our new head of sales, we have been conducting manager research reviews with a number of leading fund consultants around the world. We have also rolled out an initiative called Value Partners Academy to provide targeted knowledge sharing with institutional investors. In the intermediary and retail space, we will be rolling out a Value Partners app that will help to streamline our engagement with our distribution partners. Features of the app will include real-time fund information and commentary at the touch of a button. On the marketing front, we have been increasingly embracing low-cost and high-impact channels, including thought leadership and content marketing, and strengthening relationships with global media platforms to boost our earned media presence. I would like to take this opportunity to say a heartfelt thank you to Mr. Li Shengqin, who is stepping down today as an independent non-executive director. Mr. Li has been a valuable member of our board since 2007, and we are very grateful for his contributions throughout the years. We also welcome Mr. Wong Po Wang, who will be taking over Mr. Li's responsibilities as an independent non-executive director to Value Partners. That concludes our results presentation. Thank you, everyone. Operator, please proceed to the Q&A session. Thank you.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, we will now open the floor for questions. If you wish to ask questions, please press 01 and wait for your name to be announced. If you wish to cancel questions, please press 02. So once again, 01 for questions. Our first question is Jimmy Huang from JP Morgan.
For the call, I have two questions. First one is for the performance fees in the first half of this year. Is that mainly come from your China portfolio? And also regarding the net inflow of around 1.6 billion in the first half of this year, how much is that coming from China, and also how much is from other places? The second question is for the MRF. I think you mentioned you expect to receive the approval soon. Just try to understand when you use this one, that means next quarter or before end of this year, based on your expectation. Thanks.
Hello, Jenny. Thank you for your questions. This is Icy. So I will take your first question and pass on to King for your second question. So you are right. For the performance fee, actually most of our fellow partners brand fund are actually having December year end. So it's really up to end of the year that determine our collection of performance fee from this major fund. But then we also have some smaller Vail Partners Fund, including namely Vail Partners Taiwan Fund that has June year-end. And then another majority of the performance fee also come from our China mandates that have either quarterly crystallization date or half-yearly crystallization date. And then on the fund flow, for the 1.6 billion, I would say a majority of the inflow actually comes from our fixed income product, Greater China High Yield Fixed Income Fund. But then, as we shared, we also saw a significant growth in terms of our China mandates, including our launching of our first PFM product earlier this year. So that if you look at the geographical breakdown, you might notice that China actually today accounts for 6% of our AUM. But then I would say a majority of the fund flows, 1.6 billion, is still from the fixed income product. Yeah.
Yeah. Regarding the MRF question, based on the information shown on the CSRC website, we are ranked currently the fourth in the queue, and that's why we're expecting approval hopefully in not too distant future. Our hope is that we'll have some indication before the end of the year, but that's only our expectation given the pace of approval so far this year.
Thank you.
Our next question is Scott Russell from Macquarie. Please go ahead.
And it's Scott Russell here at Macquarie. Just a few questions actually about the net losses on investments. You adopted IFRS 9 earlier this year. Had you not done that, would the 66 million of losses been any better or any different? And then if you could just remind us, what exactly are the assets that you're marking to market there? I think you referred to them as seed capital investments, but just a bit more colour around exactly what sort of asset classes we're talking about here and whether or not they're all listed investments that have a clear market price. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Russell. This is Icy. Actually, for the new accounting standard, actually, there is no P&L impact because it basically, in the past, we record some of the longer-term investment under the available-for-sale investment. So those mark-to-market would be recognized under the reserve. But with the adoption of this new accounting standard, we actually, going forward, will need to recognize in the P&L. But then this year, the adjustment actually goes to the retained earnings. So there is no implication on our bottom line for the first half this year. So for the 66 million loss that you notice on the face of the comprehensive income, if you also look at another line, share of gain of a joint venture, that technically is our real estate investment. So including these two lines, you may find that actually our mark-to-market losses for the whole what we call treasury operations is roughly about 11 million of loss. So this mark-to-market loss mainly comes from our seeding investment in our equity funds, because in the past we also have a very wide spectrum of seeding, both in the equity funds, ETF products, as well as some fixed income products. So the loss actually mainly comes from the equity funds.
Okay, I understand. Thank you.
Thank you.
Our next question, C. Yong from Daiwa. Please go ahead.
From Daiwa. I have two questions, one on your global presence and the other on your China momentum. We've noted a rising global presence in your global offices recently, and as Dr. Oh has mentioned, most of these offices serve as distributional hubs. Just wondering, is it fair to say that in these markets that we are relatively less familiar with, we will try to rely on more distributional partners rather than try to market by ourselves to sell into the mass market? So we want to understand how and to what degree you want to cooperate with major financial institutions, especially private banks in those markets. And on the China side, earlier the other analyst also asked about MRF. What I'm trying to understand is that, well, if we assume we can get the license shortly, after that, will we continue to be very active on the PFM front? Because we already said we have one of the PFM funds planning to be launched later this year. And I guess so far, our major product focus is on PFM. So wondering if we will have any changes in our key products on the China side, assuming there are any breakthroughs on the MLF. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks for the questions, Leon. These are very good questions. First of all, regarding our global presence, yes, for most of these outposts, we focus on distribution partnership arrangement, but we also are in the process of expanding our institutional coverage. So we have been very active in Europe and or lately in Japan as well, and we will be doing roadshows in the U.S. Shortly as well, and we'll be organizing our very first client event in New York soon. So we are getting very good traction because after the Asia inclusion into the MSCI index, we have received quite a lot of inquiries and interest from major institutional clients who are now looking at China possibly as a standalone investment market. It's not just as a part of their larger emerging market benchmark exposure. And that fits well into our transformation strategy. Remember, we mentioned in previous calls that we want to identify ourselves as a China expert to the rest of the world, and that's exactly what we are trying to do with these overseas offices. And in terms of China, there are actually two different client segments that we're targeting. With the PFM, because the product will be domestic equity mainly, so we'll continue to launch more PFM products. We have a few new ideas in the pipeline. So hopefully we will launch at least a couple more before the year end. And once we have the MRF approval, our first fund will be the classic classic fund, and that will be targeting the retail market for their money investing outside of China. So again, that's a different client segment and a different market. So you know, we hope we can raise substantial AUM from that, because with this 50-50 rule on AUM fundraising, given the size of our classic is now $1.3 billion. So we hope we can raise the same amount from China. I guess through our PFM marketing, we have also been laying the groundwork for MLF, discussing with potential distribution partners on the distribution arrangement and logistic arrangement as well.
Thank you very much, Dr. Yeah,
pleasure.
As a reminder, please press 01 for questions. As a reminder, please press 01 on your telephone keypad now for questions. Our next question is Shelley Wong from Bloomberg.
I've got a question about your private equity business and how you signed an agreement for the China Education Fund. With the latest news about the draft rules coming out to regulate the sector, just want to get your take on the risks that you see or whether there's going to be any delay in expanding into private equity. Thanks.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes. We are actually excited about this new policy change because it actually clarified the direction clearer, making sure that only certain schools that will be registered as profit-making. And that means we'll expect more consolidation in this sector going forward. And that will be beneficial to our private equity fund. And so we think the timing actually works in our favor.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
As a reminder, please press 01 for questions. Please press 01 for questions. There are currently no more questions. Management, do you have any follow-up before we closing? Thank you.
No. Thank you, everyone, for joining us today.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes today's conference call. Thank you all for participating, and goodbye.